My name's Roger Newstead, and I was born on the 24th of June 1938. Ely born and bred, I went to Market Street Infant School to start with, which is now, I believe, the City Council offices, and then to Silver Street Junior School, which also is no longer, and then to the King's School. And I stayed at the King's School from 1946 to 1956.
Right. So, could you tell us about the photograph that we've just been discussing, so that we could use that?
Yes, certainly. This is a photograph which shows my great-grandfather, William Dew. He was the superintendent at Roswell Pitts, which meant that he was in effect sort of works manager or foreman equivalent today. And his job was to set the men to work, to count the number of barges of galt which were sent out, and generally maintain the property and the premises and the equipment that they used. And the picture shows him actually cutting reeds. It has been misclassified in the past as cutting osiers, but if you look carefully, they are bundles of reeds that he's cutting and putting into the barge alongside. Those reeds were basically used for thatching, although in, I think it's the month of October, St. Ethelreda's Day, he used to load them onto his donkey cart and take them up to the cathedral, and they used to lay them on the floor of the nave. The little dog you can see was a sort of Jack Russell by today's dog classifications, and according to my mother, the dog was named Rose or Rosie. Well, William Dew married a lady called Jane Long. She lived not very far away on the other side of the railway at what was then a little hamlet called Turbotsey, a collection of a pub and one or two cottages, I gather. And he unfortunately, in 1921, went at one night to make sure that the barges were secure. It was a pretty unpleasant, windy and wet night. And he caught a chill, and that developed into pneumonia, and eventually, unfortunately, he died. He lived up in Roswell Cottage at the top of Roswell Hill, up by Ely Common. As far as I know, my great-grandmother, Jane, stayed in that cottage, but his job was taken by my grandfather. My grandfather was Albert Watson. Albert came from a farming community in Littleport. His father was James Watson, a Littleport farmer, and before him Herbert Watson, and Herbert Watson's farm was called Watson's Farm on Mildenhall Road, Littleport. Albert had a brother called Walter, who was a carpenter and went to work in Cambridge, and brought his family up there, and I'm afraid we no longer have contact with them. Albert was fairly well educated for that time, and he went to Hall Cutluck and Harlock, where he worked in the office as some sort of clerical worker. And then he moved to St. Martin's Jam Factory, where he was in the accounts office, and he was obviously fairly well thought of, because in about 1908, I think it was, round about then anyway, St. Martin's decided to open a warehouse in London, in the East End of London, and they sent my grandfather up there to supervise it. About 18 months later, they decided that perhaps this wasn't such a good idea after all, so they closed it down, and of course he was made redundant, but he did get another job fairly quickly after that, with an American wine importer based, again, around the Fenchurch Street area of London. I don't know exactly where. And my grandfather, by this time, had married. And he'd married, of course, the daughter of William Dew and Jane Long.
So it was Susanna Dew, he married, my grandmother. And they set up home, first of all, in Ilford and then in Wanstead, and he commuted in each day into the city to work. About 1917, he was called up for service. He was then in his early 40s, and he served in the Royal Army Medical Corps as a medical orderly at Devonport Military Hospital in Devon, on the fringe of Plymouth. He wasn't actually discharged from the army until May 1920, although the war by then had finished a good 18 months before. When he was discharged, he found that his previous employers, the American Wine Company, had decided that it wasn't a good idea to sell wine in London during a war, and they'd packed up. So he came out of the army. He had no job to go to, and he came back to Ely. And, nepotism reigned in those days. He took over from his father-in-law. So he became the superintendent, and considerably less pay than he'd been earning up in London, but a job was a job in the 1920s, and he was glad to have it. As far as I can ascertain, my great-grandmother continued living in the cottage, and they lived in Newnham Street. Unfortunately, one very foggy night, he went down to the pits again to secure everything and make sure that everything was in order. And he stood by Kiln Lane level crossing, and a train rumbled past. And once it had gone past, he thought, right, it's safe, I'll walk across the track. Unfortunately, unbeknown to him, a train was coming in the opposite direction, and I'm afraid that was the end of my grandfather, with a very gruesome report in the Ely Standard of the time. And that was in early December 1923, which is a pretty awful time for that sort of accident to happen. My mother, it more or less killed her any chance she had of going to university or anything like that. There was no welfare state in those days, so my grandmother was almost destitute, and she had to take in lodgers and laundry and became a seamstress and that sort of thing. And they survived, mind you, and been a very happy family, but that was a disaster as far as my mother's life was concerned.
Do you actually know anything about how much clay was dug?
I don't know how much was dug. It's been going on for many years. Mm-hmm. There were brick pits on the far side of the railway, but most of the clay that's been excavated there has been used to raise the riverbanks. And it used to go out by barge. The various fen farmers in each area of Fenland formed a drainage board, and the drainage boards would buy from Roswell pits. Oh. And one of my great-grandfather's jobs and my grandfather's job was to keep a tally of how many barge loads went out to each of the drainage boards. Now, unfortunately, my great-grandfather couldn't read or write, but his wife Jane could. So Jane used to do the accounting. And indeed, my mother, that's another story why my mother was involved, but my mother also helped him to do the counting and writing the reports and all that sort of thing. Yes.
Were there, in your lifetime, or any stories of the medieval ruins? Because it was a medieval farm.
So I'm told. The answer to your question is no, I don't know. What I do know is that the pub was called the Pike and Eel.
Yes.
And it was either the Lawrence family, because they lived down there, whether they were the actual publicans or whether my great-grandmother's family, the Long family, were the other main family down there, which of those actually ran the Pike and Eel, I'm not too sure. You might like to know how my mother was involved. Mm. Albert Watson and Susanna had two children. They had my mother, who was the firstborn, and she was a very sickly child. And when he was moved to London, they decided that she would not thrive in the atmosphere up in London. It wouldn't be good for her, even though in those days Wanstead and Ilford were actually out in the sticks. They weren't like today, but nevertheless, they decided that it would be better to leave her with her grandparents. So she stayed here and was brought up by her grandparents in Roswell Cottage. So that's how my mother knows so much about the area and can tell me, or could tell me. Pits were very much smaller than they are today, and there were low embankments between the pits, separating them. They were pumped out, and the workmen would go in with spades, dig it out, put it into barrows, and there would be planks laid along on which the barrows could be wheeled. Otherwise, of course, they'd sink into the mess. Yes, it was all done by hand. Pumped out first, yes. And it was actually working one of those pumps that my great-grandfather got soaking wet and died. The beet factory was begun 1925. I think it actually started in operating in about 27. The beet was cleaned and crushed, and they took out the sort of liquid which they made into sugar. All the cake, the roughage which was left behind, was made into a slurry and pumped across the river, and also pumped around the Turbotsey area into these great big settling ponds. And gradually the water content of that settled out, and it actually was an unpleasant smell. When potters came, there was a massive bulldozing of the whole area, and they've put concrete or hardcore roadways down. I mean, none of that existed. They were all literally like pits, quite large ones, I can remember them being buns being built probably around the 1950s, when I was still here at school. But when they did it, of course, they changed the configuration of the landscape, if you like.
Yes.
Yes.
So are there, before we talk about your childhood memories, are there any other family stories that you have?
Oh, my great-grandmother and my grandmother. I mean, she followed in the family tradition. Absolutely lethal brews of wheat and barley and sugar beet, elderberry, almost anything she could make wine from. And she did a wheat wine which was almost crystal clear and had absolute knockout properties. And you would go down to the shed at the bottom of her garden where she used stoneware bottles from the brewery, sort of half-gallon things, which she stored the wine in to let it mature. And as it matured, of course, the gas would build up and blow the corks out, and they would come out with quite a bang, I can tell you. Well, I mean, blackberries. I can remember being taken out blackberrying, certainly during the war, the Second World War. You wanted almost any fruit you could get your hands on, and blackberries were a prolific source locally, and you used to take a walking stick so that you could pull the upper branches or tendrils down and pluck the more juicy blackberries off them. In my great-grandfather's garden, Roswell Cottage, there used to be he actually planted two walnut trees, and I can remember one of them being there, round about, I suppose, 1946-7, when I was old enough to be allowed off the leash and go off on my own with friends. We quite illegally climbed through the fence, and there was certainly one walnut tree there, and as I believe I told you, the remains of Roswell Cottage, bits of brick lying on the ground and tile and glass, were visible, and this would have been around about 1946-7.
So, would you like to tell us now then what you used to do as a child on Roswell Cottage?
Well, since my mother's no longer alive and can no longer reprimand me, yes. You've got to think. Remember that in those days we didn't have all the sort of gadgets and things that children have today. There was no television. Television didn't generally come in until around 1953, the coronation. That was when a lot of people suddenly bought or hired a television, and they were black and white and a little tiny screen, and you bought a sort of magnifying thing to put over the top of it to make it look a bit larger. We didn't have that. We didn't have mobile phones. We didn't have BlackBerries and all the sorts of things that they have today. It was also wartime, and there was a dearth of metal toys particularly. We had quite a number of wooden toys because the RAF hospital used woodwork as a means of helping injured airmen get back to, you know, to health and to get the dexterity of their fingers going again. So they made toys which they sold out in the town, and that raised money for the hospital. So we did have wooden toys, but they were, most of them were pretty crude. But otherwise, you went out. I mean, we didn't have this modern concern about paedophilia and all that sort of thing. You were just allowed to go out. And we played cricket in the road and tennis in the road and football in the road. The vineyards at that time was not made up. It was a sort of dirt track. And, of course, there weren't the cars that people have today. It was something of a rarity for a car to come down the vineyards. The horse and milk was delivered by a horse and a cart with a land girl and a churn and a ladle, and you used to go out with your jug and she would ladle in, you know, so many pints or whatever it was. So you're allowed to go out and wander across the fields, and many is the time I've heard either my mother or one of my friend's mothers calling out their name to try and get them to come in from three or four fields away. You know, it's time for lunch. But we used to go down Springhead Lane particularly, tree climbing, all sorts of games which these days I think would be frowned upon as not politically correct. We would play cowboys versus Indians, and you know, none of this Native American nonsense. They were Indians in those days, and red ones too. Obviously, Brits and Yanks against the Germans and the Japs. All sorts of games of that nature, pretending to shoot one another and hiding in the bushes and ambushing one another and that sort of thing. If we could find a horse chestnut tree, conkers and conker fights, again, without any eye protection or anything like that, we just played away. There were one or two trees down Springhead Lane which had been probably hit by lightning and they'd split. They were willow trees. And that enabled you to climb out on one of the branches and pretend it was a ship, you know, a pirate ship, and you know, repelling boarders and all that sort of thing. We had a lot of fun, and all things like pond dipping and getting tiddlers and water snails and that sort of thing. Not very often tadpoles. They're a very limited season, whereas these other creatures are there all the time, of course. But yeah, and as regards the pits, the security was much more relaxed on the pits than it is today. There were no sort of high barbed wire fences and protection or anything like that. We just roamed over them. And when I got a bit older, in the mid 1950s, when I was getting fairly senior in the school, we took an interest in fossil collecting. And of course, there's a proliferation of fossils in the pits. Mostly quite small and not very impressive, but occasionally they get some quite good fossils there. And just taking back to my great-grandfather, the workmen, when they were digging the pits out, would come across fossils every now and again, and he would save them. And there was a local brewer by the name of Mr. Harlock, who was a very keen on geology and fossils, and he used to take them, and some of them went to the Sedgwick Museum in Cambridge University, and some of them up to the Geological Museum in London. There was in those days a separate geological museum. It's now part of the Natural History Museum, but they have somewhere in their collections fossils from Roswell pits, mostly sort of ammonites, nothing really exciting. But very politically incorrect these days. But bird nesting was, birds' egg collecting was one of the hobbies which most boys followed in those days, certainly most country boys. And you'd have a shoebox and you'd fill it with cotton wool and very carefully place the eggs in it. you would put a pinhole at the top of the egg, and a slightly smaller pinprick at the bottom of the egg, and then you would blow the contents of the egg out, so you just had the hollow shell and you displayed that in your shoebox. But you had to collect them first, and you got a fairly good knowledge of the different types of nest made by the different species of bird, which is quite interesting. And yeah, there was a lot of fun and games. Some of the birds nest quite high up a tree, crow for example, and I remember on one occasion we were down Springhead Lane, a whole group of us, and we spotted this crow's nest, and there was a boy called Russell Fitt who came from New Barns, and he was one of these sort of natural leaders, and he was actually quite a nice chap. I got on well with him, but he volunteered to go up and get it as an act of bravado, I think, and up he climbed up the tree and was going up the trees fine. But when you get to the bird's nest and you reach in and you take out the egg, you know, well, how do we get down? So he solved that by popping it in his mouth. And down he came with considerable difficulty, and he got down to the bottom. And somebody said something to him, and the first thing he did was try to answer it and promptly swallowed the egg.
Did you swim in any part of the pits?
I didn't. I have to confess, a very poor swimmer, and I wouldn't trust myself in the pits. I mean, they were much shallower in those days than they are today. But I saw one of the pits actually emptied on one occasion. The one on the far side of the railway, almost close to the works down there. They for some reason they emptied it and pumped it out, and I was amazed how deep it was actually, and no way would I swim there. No, a few people did, but you really had to be a confident swimmer to do that. And of course, one of the difficulties, certainly in the pit this side of the road down from the Environment Agency down to Kiln Lane Crossing, the newest pit, the sides are almost sheer straight into the water, so if you got in it could well be difficult to get out.
When did you leave Ely? When did you stop having sort of regular contact with yourself?
Well, I left Ely in 1956. When I finished at the King's School, I went to university, and from university I then had to do national service in the army. And when I came out of the army, of course, I needed a job. And I'm afraid, like many other people, moved to the big city in London. And I've been around ever since then. I joined the oil industry. I've worked in America, done periods in Norway, in Belgium, France. So, you know... I've been back to Ely quite frequently as a visitor because my parents still lived here, but not to go down to the pits and explore them like we used to. Yes, it was a very disturbing time. We'd never, and indeed my parents had never experienced floods on that magnitude before, and it was really all hands to the pumps. I was at the King's School. Our term was finished early, our Lent term, and we were, all the boarders were sent home and classes finished, and the school dormitories were used for people who had lost their homes, and some, I believe, for servicemen who were drafted in to help. And as I say, it was all hands to the pumps, literally. I recall, I believe they were German prisoners of war, helping down at the pits. We also had Italian prisoners of war in Ely, but I think most of them had gone home by that time. I recall going down to Ely High Bridge and watching one of the tugs towing a string of barges, and he got caught underneath the bridge, and they had to take the funnel down so that he could actually get through, and it was desperately urgent that he could get through because he'd got a string of barges behind him all laden. The water, if I remember correctly, was about halfway up Victoria Street. The Cutter public house was more or less isolated. Way down in Springhead Lane, the water was across the marshes up to Springhead Lane, and it froze for a while, and I can recall an impromptu game of ice hockey, which we played on the sort of washland there. So we went and walked down to see what was going on. I mean, with the sort of natural curiosity of young people in those days, we didn't always realise what we were seeing.
And was that still manual digging?
No, they had, if I remember correctly, they did have drag lines by that time. Yes, I'm sure they did. It's a type of crane where they pitch the bucket out and then draw the bucket back towards them. And as it comes back towards them, of course, it fills with clay. And then they lift it and swing it out again and drop it into the barge. And lorries also, they had small tipper lorries, streams of them, coming down to be loaded. I remember they were grey coloured, and I believe they had GORB, GORB, on the sides, which was Great Ouse River Board.